Our guest for this session of the Futures Forum is Dr. Steve Cook, who's an Australia 21 Fellow and the leader of its Resilience Project. Australia 21 is one of those organisations that not nearly enough Australians know about. It's a not-for-profit organisation started in Canberra in 2001, and the organisation describes itself as an independent broker of fresh ideas about the future, and its website's certainly worth having a look at. Steve is the lead author and editor of Resilience and Transformation, Preparing Australia for Uncertain Futures, published by Australia 21 in 2010. He's currently a research associate in the Centre for Water Economics, Environment and Policy Research at the ANU in Canberra, after more than 20 years with the CSIRO. Steve's topic today is a word we hear a lot about, resilience, and I'm sure we're all very much looking forward to finding out more about just what that word means and what its implications might be for Australia's future. So over to you, Steve.
Thanks, Charles. The word resilience is one that just about everybody uses in a whole range of disciplines right across society. But one of the things I want to suggest to you tonight is that most people, when they use the word, don't really think all that deeply about what it means. And since about the 1970s, there's been an increasing number of ecologists and social scientists who've been doing research to try and understand what it means to be resilient for an ecological system or for a social system. And by resilient, I mean the ability to cope with shocks. And a number of really interesting observations or conclusions have come out of that research. I'll just share a couple with you now to get started. The first is that if you're going to think about resilience, you have to take a systems view, because resilience emerges, it's an emergent property of systems. So unless you're thinking about whole systems, there's no real way of engaging with resilience. And that system might be an individual, it might be a community, it might be an ecological system, it might be a forest or an ocean or whatever. Second observation is there are two questions that you really need to ask above everything else. It's actually one question with two parts. Resilience of what? To what? So in other words, if you're going to talk about resilience, first of all, you've got to be clear what it is that you want to be resilient. What's the thing? What is the system that you're interested in? And then what do you want it to be resilient to? As soon as you ask that second question, you're straight away getting into futures thinking, because you need to think, well, what might be coming that might threaten what we value? And so increasingly, that whole discipline of resilience research has been coming closer and closer to futures thinking, and so much so that any really leading resilience researcher that I know is either a futurist by now or working closely with futurists. So the two areas have really come together. So what I want to do today is, first of all, ask this question: why is there so much fuss about resilience at the moment? And then go on to talk about what's come out of research in terms of how you might define and conceptualise resilience. And there's a lot of observations that come out of that that I think are useful for futures thinking. Then look at what...
Is this futures knowledge?
It is. So then have a look at what factors give a system resilience, be it an ecological system or a social system. I'll introduce you to a few examples of where resilience thinking has been applied in ways that get people thinking in a different way about the future. And I'd like to finish off by just focusing on some of the big dilemmas and paradoxes that come out of futures thinking and what resilience says to us about some of those. So why the fuss? Well, part of the fuss is because the concept of sustainability is kind of running out of legs. Not that we want to throw it away. I mean, most people, I think, agree that that sustainability is a really good concept. But it tends to have been reduced to limiting or reducing our impacts in some way, using less energy, having less emissions, consuming less. What it has failed to answer is, what does a sustainable future look like? And there's a good reason for that, because there's any number of sustainable futures. So it's tended to focus, if it does focus on the future, on the sort of future we don't want, that would be unsustainable. And so resilience is one of those concepts that started to address that question, not so much what will a sustainable future look like, but what would we need to have in a society to enable us to reach a sustainable future. That's one of the key questions that resilience research has tried to focus on. But there's a whole range of other reasons why I think resilience is starting to become more in focus. Increasingly, and I'm probably not telling you anything new, but increasingly people are casting doubts on the old style of management of command and control. And I guess one of the really good examples of that, one of the early examples that led to resilience thinking, was by a fellow called Buzz Holling in Florida, where you've just been, Charles, who has, since the 1970s, studied the Florida Everglades. And that was a system where along came the US Army Corps of Engineers and said, here's a great area, it's full of water and grasses, but it's got these really fertile soils underneath it. If we can get rid of the water, we can turn it into productive farmland. So they pumped all the water out, and then they had a series of droughts, and then they had a series of heavy rains, and what they found is they created an area that was now more susceptible to extreme weather and was actually quite unproductive as well. So it's one of those examples of where we try to control everything, we actually make things worse. And the work of people like Eleanor Ostrom, a lot of work that's come out on collapse of societies. You're probably familiar with Nicholas Taleb's black swan idea, the idea that surprises are an inevitable part of the future. So that has brought the focus more on not how do we control the future and make it sustainable, but how do we cope with surprises and still manage to navigate towards a sustainable future. And now, when you look in government documents, you see the word resilience all over the place, but largely people who put it there don't fully understand what it means. And sometimes it's just a cop-out. It's a case of, oh, we can't solve this problem, so we will throw the onus back onto the community and say, you've got to be resilient, and we'll throw some money at you and hope that helps. So let's have a look at some definitions and some concepts. And as I go through this, I'm going to draw on a number of sources. A couple of books written by Brian Walker and David Salt, one called Resilience Thinking and one called Resilience Practice. There's a group called the Resilience Alliance, which was set up by the Rockefeller Foundation. It's based at the Swedish Academy of Sciences. And that has got a wealth of information about resilience. Resilience research, resilience definitions, glossaries, etc. I also want to talk about some projects that I've been involved in. One on the resilience of Australia, the Resilience and Transformation book that Charles has mentioned, but also a project done with the Academy of Science last year, getting a number of leading Australian thinkers to have some conversations about different futures for Australia. And so I'll draw on that to illustrate the way that resilience fits into some of those futures. All right. Now, the first thing to observe is that resilience researchers didn't get very far down the track until they realised that if you're talking about resilience, you need to talk about adaptability, and you also have to think about transformability when you decide that you need to change more and you don't just want to stay roughly the same. So those three concepts have become interlinked. So the resilience researchers, I'll talk about this definition of resilience in more detail in a moment, but essentially it's the capacity to keep some characteristics of a system in the face of shocks. So adaptability becomes the capacity of actors, they might be people, they might be species or whatever, the capacity of those actors to maintain that resilience. And then transformability is the capacity to do what this fish is doing, jump out of this fish bowl into a totally different one. So here's one of the most common definitions of resilience. And let me just unpick it for you. For the people who are listening on the recording, I'll read it out. The capacity of a system to absorb disturbance and reorganize while undergoing change so as to still retain essentially the same function, structure, identity, feedbacks. So that's a big, long-winded definition, but it captures a lot of the insights that have come out of this thinking. So first of all, we've got to think about a system. I've already said that. And it's about absorbing disturbance. So to some extent, it's about, I don't want to say resisting change. It's about coping with change. But it also involves a degree of reorganising. So reorganise while undergoing change. So this is the adaptation bit. So, you know, you might ask, most people when they talk about resilience, the first analogy they think about is bouncing back. And what this definition is saying is, no, it's not about coming back to being exactly the same. It's about undergoing a certain amount of change, but we're retaining some essential things about the system. The functions, the structure, the identity of the system, its feedbacks. So if you think, for example, about a stick. When I was a kid, I was a great fan of Robin Hood. So I used to like make my own bows and arrows, and I knew from watching Robin Hood that willow is the best thing to get because it bends and then it springs back again. Every so often, I would go into my dad's garage and find some other bits of wood and try and make a bow out of them, and invariably they either wouldn't bend or once you got them to bend, they'd snap. And that really is the difference between something that's resilient and something that is resistant. So the idea of resilience then is, if you think about an individual's resilience, if you have some sort of a disaster that you have to cope with, you get over it, you recover, hopefully you're roughly the same person. You've got roughly the same personality, but you're not exactly the same. You've learned lessons, there are maybe some scars or whatever. And that's what a lot of this research has shown, that you can't conceptualise resilience as bouncing back to the same thing. Now, a lot of the early definitions of research of resilience were measuring things like how long does it take for the system to come back to being the same. These guys, once they thought about it in more detail, they thought that doesn't work. That really doesn't work in any system. And you can see that organisations have started to think about resilience as well. So here's a definition from Robert McClelland when he was the Australian Attorney General. So he's talking about organisational resilience as being more than simply preventing a range of identifiable risks. It's about being able to continue to meet objectives in the face of significant disruptive circumstances. So you've got to be clear what your objectives are and then work out how you're going to still meet those even though things are being disrupted. And coming back to the definition of social ecological resilience, one of the things that resilience thinking has forced us to do is to ask, what are these essential functions, structures, identities and feedbacks? So if we say we want to have a resilient society, what is it about that society we want to keep? And that's the thing that often people don't think about. They say we want to be resilient. Well, okay, what is it that you want to keep? And do you want to keep everything, in which case you really are trying to resist change? Or are there some essential elements of our society? Charles, this gets back to what you're talking about to me earlier about visions for the future. What are the things that we want to still have in the future that we want to keep resilient to the things that might be driving change? Or which things can we allow to change? So very early on, Buzz Holling and others started to think about other disciplines. And one of the disciplines that talks a lot about resilience is engineering. And so this distinction was drawn between engineering resilience and social or ecological resilience. So if you build a bridge, you really want it to stay looking like a bridge, and you really don't. You want it to be able to sway a bit in the wind, but you don't want it to bend out of shape or come something different. So engineering resilience is largely about keeping something the same. Whereas an ecological system, so these are, there's a picture here of savannas in northern Australia. Sometimes they can be full of shrubs and trees. Sometimes after a fire there's not much grass there, but it's still the same system. And so there's a certain amount of change. Now these systems, if they're overgrazed, can end up turning into woody weed infested lands, and they've become a different system. So that's when their resilience is overpowered. So the concept of resilience here is that there are some boundaries that define a grassy woodland, and the resilience of the system is its ability to stay within those boundaries and not suddenly become a woody weed infested system. One of the analogies that's often used to try and make sense of this is this pothole analogy. Some people really love it, and some people just think it's a load of rubbish. So see if it works for you. If you imagine a couple of potholes in the road, sort of smooth, round potholes, and there's a pebble in there, and the wind is blowing or it's raining and it's pushing the pebble around, the pebble can be in a number of different places within that pothole, but it's still within the same pothole. So the idea is that the resilience thinkers call this a basin of attraction. So the ball or the pebble keeps moving around, but it keeps getting drawn back to the bottom of the pothole. And to make that analogy a little bit more tangible, if you've got a grassland, it'll move around within that basin of attraction. It'll become more or less grass, but it'll still be a grassland and ultimately will swing back to being its kind of normal state. The idea then is, if there's enough force, that pebble will get pushed out of that pothole into another pothole, and that analogy is about going into a different state. So that would be the grassland changing to a weed-infested woodland, and the driver for that would be overgrazing normally, because there's not enough grass left in the system to carry a fire. This is a system view. And then, so the fire doesn't burn, and that means that the grass dies out and the woody weeds take over. So, getting back to this question of resilience of what to what. So if you want to think about some of the towns in Victoria that were burned in the fires a few years ago, you might want to think they want to be resilient to fire. That's clearly a threat that they want to be resilient to, but what is it they want to retain? Is it the actual buildings? Obviously it's people's lives. What is it about their community that they want to be able to maintain? So we very often focus on the to what bit, the pressure that may be pushing us to a different state, but we sometimes don't think too much about what it is that we want to protect. And we can have a look at this in another way, which is to think about two different types of resilience. And again, the resilience thinkers, what they've done for four decades really is just think ever more deeply about how can we make sense of this concept. And one of the things that's come out is we really have to think about these two different types of resilience. Specified resilience, which is resilience to some particular force, like a fire or a flood. And so if we take the example of New Orleans, that was a city that knew it was threatened by floods. So it put a lot of investment into protecting itself from floods. It had levee banks all around the place, and it had various protocols in place to deal with floods. When Hurricane Katrina came along and the levee banks broke and the city was flooded, they found that they didn't have much general resilience. And general resilience is resilience to cope with the unexpected. And what New Orleans found out was poor people didn't have much support. A lot of the emergency services didn't work. There wasn't a whole lot in some areas of people just helping one another. It was every man for himself in some places. So the interesting thing about these two types of resilience is that they often trade off against each other. So if you've got limited resources and you put a lot of resources into protecting yourself against a known threat, you might neglect general resilience. You might argue at the moment, for example, with the threat of terrorism. If we don't manage that well, we might have very effective borders and we might be very good at catching people who are terrorists, but we might not build up a lot of social capital amongst people. We might have a whole lot of scared people who are afraid to talk to one another, and therefore if something happens, they don't have a lot of general resilience. So it's important to think about those trade-offs. And so when we are thinking about the future, if we're thinking about this sort of trade-off, it's one of the sorts of things that can set us off in one direction versus another. The other thing that's really at the heart of resilience thinking is the idea of these thresholds. That if you're in one pothole, if you then move into another pothole, you've crossed a threshold. So a lot of the way that resilience has been conceptualized has been about trying to know where those thresholds are, how close you are to them, what's pushing you towards them. And if you can have some idea how close you are, then the closer you get, the less resilience you've got, the less it'll take to push you over the threshold. And you need to then, your way of dealing with that situation is to try and find ways to pull back from that threshold. So in an ecological system, a good one actually is in rural areas, there's a perception by people living in those areas that if you get below about 30% forest cover, you've no longer got a natural system. You're in in farmland. And so that becomes a bit of a threshold. And in many parts of the world, people then try to manage these agricultural systems to try and get them above about 30%, because then people start to see them as a natural system that needs to be treated like a natural system. So salinity is another issue that's big up in the Golden Broken, where I've done a lot of work, and there's a threshold of once the salinity gets to within a couple of metres of the surface, it speeds up and comes to the surface. So a lot of the management has been to try and keep that water table lower than the 2 metres. Now, here's an example from North America where a lot of this resilience research has been done. In lakes in Wisconsin, it was observed that every so often the lakes would just be perfectly clear one day and then totally polluted and full of algae the next. And a lot of research was done to find out why that happened. And what they found was that phosphorus was washing off the farmland, gradually building up in the mud at the bottom of the lake. And once it got to a certain level, it only took a bit of a storm to flush it all out, and suddenly it would be released and there'd be an algal bloom, and so the lake would become polluted overnight. Now the interesting thing about this is that it's quite clear what the threshold is, it's quite clear what to do to stop it. And they tried to introduce this thinking into policy making, and what they found was that no matter what you did, the decision makers kept waiting until they had proof, and then it was too late. And you just couldn't get a system where people would act soon enough to manage the system. So that's one of the big challenges for resilience, is that ability. And you know, you read books like Jared Diamond's Collapse and...
I didn't want to interrupt.
No, fine.
That's surely the whole notion of the precautionary principle is the fundamental that you've got in order to get the head around. The notion of, well, let's be absolutely certain we're all going to die before we do anything about the risk, as opposed to, well, in the absence of proof that we're not safe, we're going to assume we might not be. We've got a very strong sustainability model that's about social, economic and environmental objectives all joined up, and interestingly it's served by an organisational model, my doctoral topic, that's about not having command and control. It all neatly fits in with what you're talking about. But it's just, surely we should always be teaching precautionary principle at school. Like this moronic logic that says, well, we're not absolutely quite sure we're going to die yet, so we'll just keep going. Anyway, I felt the need to say it.
No, and please, look, do interrupt if you've got something to say, because I don't want this to be just a lecture. But someone was telling me yesterday they had been to a climate change summit in Canberra, and there were a couple of climate change deniers there, and one of them got up and said, the previous chief scientist said 5 years ago that we had 5 years to act on climate change. It's 5 years later and we're not all dead, so what's the big deal? And it just happened that the ex-chief scientist was there, and she got up and she said, well, actually what I said was, within that 5 years we've got to start taking action or we've missed our opportunity in the long term. But, you know, it's the same.
But you know, tell me to shut up, but this is a distraction. But it was interesting that Bob Carr and I don't know whether it was Kevin Rudd or John Thwaites at Future Summits had both said the human mind is wired to not look at really, really, really scary things until the moment when they know they have to. It's part of how we're wired.
Yeah.
That assumes you know when that moment is.
Yes.
The problem is, we don't know when the moment is.
You usually know it in retrospect.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, just before you.
And I agree with you that, I mean, to me that's the big challenge that we face with not just with climate change but a lot of things is and the thing about these sort of thresholds is they're mostly driven by slow variables. And we react to fast variables. So things that are happening quickly we react to. Things that are happening slowly we kind of think, oh, we've got time, we'll deal with that later. So getting away from ecological systems, there's all sorts of other thresholds in society. There are thresholds in the way crowds behave. There are thresholds in the way the stock market works. You know, when you get enough nervous people, suddenly there's a run on stock. And even if you look at the rise of social media, it was something that happened really slowly. And in the early days, people thought never going to amount to anything. And then all of a sudden, there was a critical mass, and it all happened. So there are thresholds all around the place. And what resilience research is saying is we need to think about these slow variables and where they might be leading. But to know what the consequence might be, we've got to be clear what it is that matters to us. And that's one of the conversations we rarely have. We don't really have a vision for the future of Australia, for example. Or, you know, most countries don't have a vision for their future. Okay, so a lot of the research has looked at systems that have been resilient and tried to learn in retrospect what gave them resilience. And here's a list of things that that give resilience. And for the people listening on the tape, I'll go through each of these one after the other so you'll know what I'm talking about. The first one is diversity, and it's pretty obvious, really. If you've got a range of different resources, different attitudes, different beliefs, you've got more options to choose from to try and find solutions. Now, one of the projects we did with Australia 21 was to get a group of people together and say, what do you think is happening with the resilience of Australia? And this is one of the things they were really concerned about. We're doing a whole lot of things to reduce diversity, trying to get all schools to teach the same thing, reducing duplication in universities. We used to have about 5 or 6 forestry departments around Australia. I think it's down to 1 or 2 at the moment. So there's diversity in species, there's diversity in beliefs and skills that are all important. And I guess if we're thinking about the future, if we're doing scenario planning, if we think about processes that are likely to reduce diversity, they're likely to be putting us in a more fragile situation. The other thing that's come up is thinking about the way our networks are arranged, and the term modularity is often used. I've tried to find a simple word that means the same as this, and I can't find one. The idea is that if you've got a totally centralized system, so everything's controlled from the middle, if the middle collapses, everything collapses. So that is a very unresilient system. It's very susceptible to collapse. The most resilient sort of system, in many ways, is a distributed network where everything's connected to everything else and no individual sees the whole system. This is the way terrorist networks are set up, and that's why they're so hard to...
That's a natural system. If you look at how fungus grows, it grows actually in a distributed way. One part can die off, not
a
battlefield.
Yeah. Now, I guess the difficulty with that sort of system, if you try and set it up in a society, it can be a little bit hard to control, maybe too hard to control. So the kind of compromise is a modular system where you've got some control from the centre and then you've got satellites, and each of those has got satellites. If one part fails, it doesn't bring the whole system down. It certainly has some vulnerabilities. And we see this a lot where you've got a key person in a community that everything, Charles and the Future Foundation, remove you, and it's not as resilient as a system. But it would still probably survive. So there's been a lot of thinking about that idea of modularity. A lot of the people who do research on networks have discovered that humans love to set up centralized systems that are unresilient. So we're working against ourselves a lot of the time. One of the things that comes out of this is the idea of adaptive management or polycentric governance, or sometimes talked about, the term subsidiarity is talked about. The idea that you really need to devolve decision-making responsibility and authority to the lowest level where it can be exercised. That doesn't mean that you always devolve everything, it just means that very often there are functions that can be done on a much lower level than in Canberra or in Melbourne. So that's one of the big themes that has come out of work by people like Eleanor Ostrom, who's a social scientist who got the Nobel Prize not long ago. She's unfortunately passed away since then. So that's one topic that's been bubbling up around resilience. And one of the other consequences of thinking about those networks is that if you're going to have communication and exchange of information in a system, you often need to have connections. We all know, we all talk about silos that exist in government, but they exist everywhere. And this paper that was published in Science in, 2009, was talking about these missing institutions. So if we think about the range of global drivers we've got to deal with, like changing carbon and nitrogen cycles and increasing antibiotic resistance, nuclear proliferation, each of those will affect things like climate, ecosystems, health, and the economy. And if we're going to deal with those impacts, we need a range of institutions. And the analysis that was done here suggested that a lot of those key institutions are missing. And they often tend to be linking institutions that form links between silos. And they're the sorts of things that we tend to cut when we want to save money. So that's another outgrowth of that resilience thinking. And again, you know, thinking in this way can enrich our futures thinking. I've already mentioned considering slow variables and thresholds. That's one of the attributes of a resilient system, that we are aware that these things exist, and we are aware and we are looking for these slow changes. And when you, again, when you read books like Jared Diamond's Collapse, or was it Joseph Tainter before him that talked about the collapse of complex societies, the theme that runs through that is societies that weren't watching the slow changes. Tight feedbacks. Finding out how things are going. Getting early warning that changes are happening. And that all comes down to people communicating. If you go back to the 90s, there was a lot of talk about the learning organisation, and one of the fundamental components of that was staff being able to give management feedback about how things are going. So that's community action, community discussions, very good. I'm running a course at the ANU at the moment with 55 foreign students, and I was talking to them at one stage about how difficult it is to get Australians to come together and have conversations as communities. Some of these people just shook their heads. The ones from Indonesia said, "Oh, we've got village councils, and everyone comes together and we talk about things." So, you know, it's one of the things that's probably missing from our society, not necessarily missing from a lot of others. But you can have connections that are too tight, and you get to the point where you get stagnation. So Jürgen Randers, who some of you might know, a futurist from Norway, he reckons he used to have 16 scenarios for the future of the world. He's now got one. We're just going to bumble along, because he reckons America, Europe, Australia, all tied up. We can't make decisions. We're not going to be able to act on anything. His one hope is that China will be able to do something.
So can I just ask, are you looking back to climate when you say that? Because that seems to be the thing that, because again, yeah. I don't know, tell me if this is a dead end street, but ultimately the actuaries are the ones that are going to cause us to change. I mean, you know, when the super funds have their actuaries saying, but you've got those coal reserves valued at $35 billion and we don't think you're going to be able to sell it. I mean, that, and I think we're approaching that point now where, you know, the number crunches, because they can't be ignored. Everybody else can be ignored, but when the actuaries say you've got to change the value of the assets in your books, you can't say, oh, we don't believe you, so we're going to ignore you. Well, I don't know where you have a view about that.
Well, I suppose that's one of the feedbacks that might save us. So long as it happens fast enough.
Well, it's starting to, you know, when you've got huge organisations like BHP Billiton and others where, you know, their balance sheet suddenly looks like it's not what people thought, and actuaries are not politicians, they're just people who call it as they see it. So
yeah.
I'm not sure whether it's next year or the year after or in 5 or 10, but it's not 20 years away.
No, well, you know, there's a group of people that are aligned with this resilience research who have been trying to look at how you get the value of the environment in into the economic debate.
Yep.
And they've been using traditional economics for ages. And I was talking with one of them, Bob Costanza, the other day, and he is now going, he's now developing a project where he wants to go to the insurance industry and say, what would it cost to insure our natural resources? And see what they come up with. And I think you're right, the actuaries could be very powerful in that regard. Now, there's a bit of a contradiction here, I guess, because a moment ago I was talking about the need for connections, and now I'm talking about them being too tight. So there's a thing that underpins a lot of the resilience thinking, and it's called the adaptive cycle. And the idea is that systems start off very simple, and they start to grow. And when they start growing, they've got a lot of resources and a lot of flexibility and a lot of options. Gradually, they get more and more complex. They use more and more of the resources. They can do more and more things, but then they get to a stage where they're kind of getting old and they're conserving energy, and that's where a system can get really tied up. And it actually is no longer resilient because it can't really respond quickly. And so in an ecosystem, usually what happens there is there's some sort of a release, like a fire or a storm that knocks all the trees down, and the system reorganizes and builds up again. And the same thing seems to happen with social systems. Sometimes it can be a total collapse, thousands of people die, there's a war, whatever. Sometimes it can be a more subtle collapse when we reorganize. This sort of cycle you see in businesses where a new CEO will do a whole lot of reorganizing. In some ways, that's like an adaptive cycle. So that kind of gives you that other perspective of, yes, you've got to have the right linkages, but as time goes on, things can get too interlinked. Global financial crisis, good example of a system that just was so tightly linked that when one part started to come down, it all came down. So that's one idea, and you can see this starts to get more and more complicated. At some level, whereas at other levels there are some simple messages. And one of the complications is this idea called panarchy, which is that these adaptive cycles, I drew it as a nice simple circle, but it's often driven as a figure eight, with things getting more complex and then collapsing and reorganizing. But the idea of panarchy is that these cycles are going on at different levels. And if you want to understand the resilience of some part of a system or some system, you really need to look at what's happening above it and below it. So if you're interested in the resilience, say, of the health system in Victoria, you need to have a look at what's happening nationally and internationally, and you need to look at what's happening locally, because they all interact in different ways. And that's one of the other insights that's come out from all of this. Social capital is important. People, the social institutions where people can help one another in times of disaster, and that's something, you know, it's something that often gets forgotten. It's not the sort of thing that governments invest in explicitly, because, you know, it's not something that you can really announce, and it's very hard to measure, but if it's not there, you soon find out about it. And innovation, the ability to come up with new ideas, I guess that's tied back a lot to diversity and to the sorts of connections you've got. But interestingly, I came across this just the other day, this fellow David Woods from Ohio State University published a paper where he was saying, or he actually gave a presentation where he was talking about innovation as the flip side of resilience. And I thought, what's this all about? When I read about it, I realized that he was saying the same thing as a lot of resilience researchers have been saying, is that if you become too resilient, it's hard to change. So we're used to thinking of resilience as a good thing, but the other idea that's come out is resilience is not always good. Very often you've got systems that you want to change and you can't change, so your problem becomes not building resilience but dismantling it. And so when you're thinking about change, resilience thinking helps you assess a system, what's giving it resilience, what do we need to pull apart. We've done some work in Australia 21 on health systems around the country. They're very resilient. People keep trying to change them. They've been trying to change it for decades, and they just keep bouncing back to the same thing. And that's why David Woods was talking about resilience sometimes being the enemy of innovation, because if you if you've got a very resilient system, it's hard to change. So that makes it even more complicated. The other word, which is sometimes seen as a derogatory word, is redundancy. These days we always talk about redundancy as being a bad thing, but resilience researchers recognise redundancy as an important part of resilience. So if you think about a sedge land, which this picture is of in northern Australia, you can look at all the different plants that live there, and you can look at the functions that they play in the system. They might be recycling nitrogen, or they may be the fungi producing, spreading carbon through the system. They might be nitrogen fixers, whatever. So this figure, which people listening to this can't see, but it's just a histogram showing all the species that are in this system and what functions they play. Some of these functions, like the ones that are labelled B, C and E, are present amongst the dominant species, but the only other place they're present is in these really rare species. And very often our approach to an ecosystem is to say, well, those rare species don't matter too much, and at the moment they don't. But if the climate changed and the dominant species no longer could perform those functions, if there isn't something that can replace that, then you've got a system that collapses. And the same thing applies in organisations and societies. Quite often we think we can get by with just one of everything, which brings me to this next point, that the pursuit of efficiency in a very simple, narrow way is often the enemy of resilience, because we reduce redundancy, we reduce diversity, we go for what works best and we streamline everything, and it works fine for the moment, but we don't have flexibility for the future. So all of that sounds really, really complicated, but it really does boil down to some simple things, that you need to have those right sort of connections, you need to have diversity, and if you've got those things, then you've got the ability to anticipate what those thresholds might be. You'll never know exactly what they are, but you could be thinking about them and watching for them and thinking about how you'll respond. Now I'm talking exactly about futures thinking, so there's where one of the overlaps is. You'll be able to self-organise. This is actually, to me, one of the most difficult aspects of resilience thinking to get across to government policymakers, that in a lot of government documents it talks about we want a resilient Australia, we want resilient communities. Well, the research says let them self-organise. That's the way you'll make them most resilient. But governments don't like that. They don't trust the public to be able to self-organise, and it might not work. So that's a big problem, I think. And then you've got the ability to learn and adapt. And they are things that we've known forever, but we hadn't thought about them in all that much depth. What does it mean to be able to learn and adapt? What does it mean to be able to cope with the unexpected? So resilience thinking is starting to give us some insights into that. Right. Let me just give you some examples of how this has been applied. So first example is the Goulburn Broken catchment in Victoria. So what they did here was they sat down and developed a narrative. They said, what's happened in this catchment since Europeans arrived? In the early phase, there were lots of resources. The opportunities were endless. We had lots of resilience. If we had a drought or we had heavy rains, not much damage. The river flowed normally, produced lots of food. But gradually, there was more and more production. The water table started to come up. Productivity started to drop. Lots of steps were taken to try and deal with salinity. This program was developed, that program was developed, and we end up today with a system that is on the verge of collapse because it really has no room to move. It's all tied up, they're pumping constantly to try and keep the water table down. Every time the market fluctuates, people go out of business. So then what they did was applied some systems thinking. They said, what are the sorts of thresholds that exist in our system? What are the main components? And they listened to that message about panarchy, and they said, what are the things that are happening at different scales? So at the farm scale, we've got things like farm financial viability, the acidity of the soil, managing the water table. At the landscape region, we've got things like the size of the dairy and fruit processing sectors, water infrastructure, tree cover. And then at the state or nation scale, or cutting across all those scales really, we've got people's values. And whether they want agriculture, whether they want conservation, whether they want beautiful big houses and lawns or whatever. And then you've got a whole series of shocks. Well, a whole series of shocks like price shocks, climate shocks, diseases and the rest. And then they ask themselves, how do these things interlink? So one example might be that early in the evolution of life in this catchment, people's values were about productivity. So everything went into boosting production. That ended up reducing tree cover and bringing the water table down, which then affected farm financial viability, which then affected the size of the dairy and fruit processing sectors, which then fed back to people's values. And at each stage here, there were slow changes that got to a point where all of a sudden people realised, oh my God, salinity is creeping up on us. Or, oh dear, the fruit industry is about to collapse. And they're not things that were planned for, they were things that crept up and all of a sudden we had to panic. So that was the way that the community in that catchment applied resilience thinking and systems thinking to try and diagnose what situation they were in. So the same sort of thing was done in the Central West, similar sorts of components, and they thought explicitly about the sorts of transitions between different phases in the catchment. I'm not going to go into detail, but just letting you know that there are various catchment groups around the place that are applying systems thinking and resilience thinking as a way to understand what's going on. The Namoi catchment did something similar. They were a bit resistant to start with, and Brian Walker and Paul Ryan sat down with them and said, look, why don't you just have a go at mapping out the way your system works. So they jumped in and they started looking at water and they started looking at vegetation and cotton and coal. And out of that came the realisation that a lot of the social processes going on in the catchment were really central and weren't being thought about. And they were driving the way the catchment was managed and they were being influenced by the way the catchment was being managed. So they really started to think then of their system as being a coupled social and ecological system rather than just a social system sitting on top of an ecological system. So this sort of thinking does get you thinking about things a bit differently. And we applied some of this in the most recent State of the Environment report. And by doing that, we were then able to start developing a decent outlook. It's not perfect. But State of Environment reports in the past have sort of got to the end and said, oh, this might happen in the future. We were able to think about these sorts of processes that were going on in terms of resilience and whether we were going to be able to achieve some of the things we'd like to achieve and then how that might influence the way the future unfolds. How am I going for time? I've only got a few more minutes left, but I'd like to share the example of New Orleans with you. There's a nice paper by Stuart Chapin and colleagues that was written in 2010, published in Trends in Ecology and Evolution. And they applied a resilience analysis to New Orleans. So the first thing, and this is kind of an example of how resilience analyses are being done around the place. First thing is to think about the system. And in New Orleans' case, there is natural built human and social capital. So the natural capital is the barrier islands, the built capital is the levees, the human capital is hydrological skills and other skills and knowledge, and then the social capital is neighbourhood networks. They interlink with the dynamics of sediment flows and land development and flood control, disaster relief, etc. So that becomes the coupled social ecological system that's there. So then they looked at, so that's the, if you're thinking about resilience of what to what, that's the of what. The to what is the things that are shocking that system. And in New Orleans' case, it was a combination of hurricanes and land subsidence, according to this analysis, which resulted in the impacts of flooding and then loss of life and property. So that's a description, if you like, of the system and the impacts of Hurricane Katrina. The other bit then is the bit where we try to learn. we look at how we're coping or not coping. We think of innovative new ways to do things and how we're going to adapt. So all that very interesting, and it produces some really nice conversations and thinking. But to me, the really insightful bit was the possible futures that came out of this analysis. And to me, it's a very stark statement of where you go when you start thinking about resilience and transformability. So the argument was, new elites has got the option of persisting if they want to. If they can adapt and go back to what they had before but do it better, they can stay the same. Or they can choose to be different, and then they can make a new society the way they want. If they do neither of those, then they face the possibility of ending up with an unintended transformation that they might not want. And to me, that's a really useful sort of way to put things to people, that if you don't think about your resilience and your ability to cope with shocks, then those shocks could send you off somewhere that you don't really want to be, which is the story of collapsed civilizations throughout the ages. So that's an interesting example. I mentioned that we'd done this work in Australia 21, thinking about Australia's resilience. And, you know, the sorts of things that come out of talking to people about Australia's resilience is exactly what you'd expect. The economists were saying, we need to increase Australia's level of savings to give us that extra capacity. I guess one of the interesting observations that came from Nick Gruen was that in his view, we survived the global financial crisis by accident. We just happened to have reasonably low overseas debt and reasonably high savings at the time. It wasn't planned, according to him, but it did give us resilience, even if it was an accident, so we can learn from it. And there's a lot of conversations about running down social capital and what have you. I won't go into that unless you want to talk about it later. But the point is that resilience thinking gave us a way to focus. This is the project we did with the Academy of Science. The first phase of this was to take a group of 40 scientists away and get them to think about Australia's future. So we argued for 5 days and we came up with some ideas. But I was supposed to be facilitating a group of futurists who were to come up with a set of scenarios. And in 5 days we couldn't do it because we just kept arguing with each other. And the observation that came out of that was, well, if a group of experts can't do this, then how do we expect the rest of society to listen to our wisdom, even if we do manage to get something? And so out of that we decided what's really needed is to try and get people to have their own conversations about the future. And we decided to do that by inviting 60 leading Australians who've shown the ability to think broadly, but who haven't been involved in futures thinking before. And we got them to focus on these four archetype scenarios. See you again. A growth expansion one, a restraint sustenance sort of sustainability one, a catastrophic one, and a transformation one. Now, a couple of interesting things came out of this. One was, we had people who lean very much to the right of politics and very much to the left and everything in between, but almost all of them could not imagine the current type of economic growth continuing. A lot of them were in favour of continued growth, but they wanted to see technology decoupling consumption from growth. They wanted to see growth in ideas or other things other than money. But it was that kind of unanimous inability to see just business as usual continuing. Lots of people could imagine what a restraint or sustenance future might be like. We wouldn't be driving around in such fancy cars, and we'd be living more of a community lifestyle and being more careful with our consumption, but most people could not figure out how that would come about. People had no trouble thinking about catastrophes, but to me the real shock was virtually everybody, when you asked them to think about a transformed Australia, we expected them to be thinking about space age technologies and everything. But what they came up with was a country where people cared about one another, that were community focused, supportive, all the things you'd want in resilience, and they said that would be a future that's fundamentally different from what we've got now, which, you know.
The key word in all of that is selfishness. Because that's the thing. I mean, even going back to our sustainability model, was really about making it a whole lot harder for people to be selfish.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Everybody says, I don't care what you want, I want this. You create a model that says social, economic, environmental goals all coming together, etc. You force people to take a less selfish position. But how outside this window here you get people out in the world to be less selfish. One of the problems of getting older is you say they're not going to do it. And, you know, some sadness. And it's not just me. I mean, a lot of, you know, people that I connect with in not only my work but in the other things that I do are of the same age and stage saying, well, we've all been at this for an incredibly long time and people are continuing to make almost totally selfish decisions, including intergenerationally, obviously, to come back to the sustainability of the planet. So I'm not sure what the end goal here is, but if you're going to actually try to get to that transformation at some point, I mean, again, this might be another dead end street, but having the week of the budget, and it happened on that Friday night, we on the peninsula had Tony Abbott speaking at a huge function, and I found the budget very distressing, as a lot of other people did. People like me, you know, getting hit for $1.50, and people with nothing getting hit for 10% of it. And I found it stunning, talking to Tony Abbott on the Friday night, that he didn't care at all.
Really?
He didn't care. The only good part about the week was the extent to which that ordinary people said, this is not okay. Mm. And are still saying, this is not okay. It's the one thing you grab hold of in all of this, that Australia generally is saying we're not comfortable with the level of selfishness that you're looking to impose. I mean, apart from Corey Bernardi and a whole range of other wackos. So how do you, that's all great, you know, I'm with the program, but how are you going to at some point How do you create the discontinuity that brings about a transformation where, you know, it's about being a little less selfish? It's a big, big, big challenge.
Well, it is. But my optimistic side, I mean, I think the great contribution of resilience thinking, and it's not that different from a lot of the thinking probably many of you have already been used to if you're systems thinkers or whatever, but is that it gets you contemplating the way that societies either collapse or persist. And if you think about slow variables, it's quite possible that there are slow changes going on, and we sit here and say, oh, we've been trying doing this all our lives and nothing's happened. But maybe things have been happening and they are building to a threshold and we might see some change. The other thing that came out of some of that work we did asking people about the resilience of Australia, some of them said, every so often you do get a shock that makes us reflect on what's important. And in some ways, you know, Tony Abbott may be forcing us to have some of those conversations that we haven't had in the past because it didn't really matter. Both sides of politics did silly things, but by and large everything was good, and all of a sudden he's challenging some of our thinking. So.
Going back, I mean, the level of interest in the political process and, you know, all that stuff, in well-off countries, and we are a well-off country in relative terms, you know, younger generations say, I don't want to watch a real news program, I want to watch The Project because it's amusing. And so, because, I mean, the going back a few decades to when I was a little younger than I am now, politics was, or the running of the country was much simpler than it is now. So you could have the Prime Minister come to your secondary school, as we did, and, you know, people could understand what's going on. Now people say, I don't understand what they're doing, because I don't know if you know the sort of complex, wicked global cognitive model that Rufus Black talks a lot about. Well, you know, for most people they say, yeah, I don't think I care, I think I'll go watch the footy. And so the you've got selfishness and indifference running together. It's a very powerful, very powerful, I mean, that's a force that's very hard to work against. When things are crap, then people will all say, okay, we're going to do something. Our problem is that things aren't crap enough.
Yeah.